Welcome, and thank you for tuning into Open Talk with your host, Grant Garrison.
Thank you for joining us. Welcome to Open Talk with yours truly, Grant Garrison. And today we're going to be meeting with Gibson Elliott and talking to him about Metatopia Multiverse. Gibson is going to share with us all of that wonderful history on the project. And without further ado, Mr. Gibson Elliott, thank you so much.
So, what did you want to talk to me about today, Grant?
Well, I actually came across, I was looking up you, and came across an interesting webpage I didn't know anything about called Project Metatopia Multiverse. It says the future of social networking is coming. I'm on the webpage right now over here. It says new for 2010, so we're going back more than 12 years now.
12 years.
And the page is on metatopia.sourceforge.net. Tell me about Mark DeGroot and Metatopia Multiverse.
Well, Mark DeGroot was the older brother of my best friend when I was living in Paris, France. We initially went to the same school together, and then later he went off to the American High School in Paris. But Mark was this quirky guy, one of the few I've ever met in Paris that had a ham radio antenna tower installed on the building. And I would find him on a Saturday morning out there going, CQ, CQ. Reaching around the world and enjoying being able to bounce signals off the ionosphere to talk to people as far away as Russia and Canada from Paris. Mark was a very quirky individual. It wasn't until we all wound up back in the States around 1979 that we all hooked back up in Berkeley, California. We'd all made these big loops around the country, around the world when we were young. And I had already started my career in electronics, and I had also been, you know, one of the early gamers. I loved Ultima 3D. It was one of the first wireframe, first-person dungeon crawlers, if you will, and absolutely adored it, spent way too many hours in it, and I wanted to design a system that used a pair of surplus helicopter monocles, you know, the ones they have that come down out of their eye.
Oh, yeah, Blue Thunder style.
Right. So my idea was to take two of them and create a VR environment.
Right.
And so this was in 1984.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. We were sitting in the attic room of a place, a house, that was the home of the cosmic, great cosmic muffin family. You know, okay. Berkeley. It was a fun time. It was crazy. It was outlandish. There's still, you know, a thriving hippie community. Nice. And you know, we all shared a lot of the old ideals of, you know, peace, love, not war, all this good stuff. But so there we were in the attic with the Muffin family house in Oakland, and I told Mark about my idea for this, and he just latched onto it. He thought, oh my god, this is brilliant. And I told him, go right ahead, have fun with it, do whatever you like, you have my permission, no problem, I'll never begrudge you that. Well, fast forward to 2010, and sadly, I had found out that Mark had committed suicide after spending just endless hours, estimated 20,000 man hours, building Metatopia. And the idea was for paraplegics, quadriplegics, shut-ins, and people who were generally bedridden, to give them an environment where they could go out and feel free in VR. To fly, to walk, to run. And so he built this thing to do just that. And now, he had also at that time moved to Colorado. Yeah, and started what was known as the first VR business ever in the world.
No kidding.
And, yeah, and you know, his life ended tragically.
Yes.
And I didn't find out until about 4 years later.
Oh, what a blow.
Yeah, you know, so I missed the boat, missed his funeral, missed everything.
Oh, so sorry.
That's all right. His parents followed through with creating a website dedicated to Mark Davka DeGroot, because he had adopted the name Davka. He'd left Judaism and had pursued, you know, the sort of hippie perspective of getting into Buddhism and all these other things. And so he actually adopted the name Dafka. Now, there's a memorial website up for him that deals with raising money for research into depression.
Very good.
Right. So yeah, that was very, you know, one of the few positive things that came out of it. But when I discovered that this had happened, I went out and I found the project on SourceForge. I also connected with a dozen or so people that had worked with him over the years, and they're still connections on LinkedIn now. As I was trying to understand, you know, what happened, where he had gotten to, what was going on in general. At the time, I had to petition SourceForge to take ownership of the project. And after a while of petitioning, I did finally get it. And at the time, I was inspired to create a whole new system. Now, if you go to the Metatopia Multiverse pages, you'll find that my vision included I was going to call the extranet. And on the extranet, effectively, every VR setup could communicate to every other VR setup directly over a WiMAX connection, which is essentially a high-powered peer-to-peer Wi-Fi network. And as such, the idea was to create a peer-to-peer network outside of the control of companies that were controlling the internet, right? And along with that, you could buy a box for your business that you just plug into your internet, and it would transmit a short range signal that would essentially broadcast up to about 20 feet outside of your business, a VR environment, where if you had on a headset and you were walking by a business and you looked towards them, just like in, Back to the Future, where Marty McFly looks at the movie theater and the shark jumps out at him. Hey. Right? Great visual. And it's exactly like that. So you could be strolling down the street with your VR headset on and look at a store, and poof, there's sails rotating in the air, you know, kind of like Blade Runner, you know, how they had the everything everywhere. So when Meta announced the metaverse, I about blew snot out my nose laughing because I, you know, guess what, guys? I thought about that 12 years ago. Welcome to the bandwagon. Yeah. Now, why didn't I pursue it? Well, at the time I started it, I had just finished laying out the plans for everything and started organizing, trying to get volunteers to help work on it. I went through a very messy divorce. And that really just kind of killed it for me for a long time. And I knew I wasn't going to have the resources or money, so I just kind of let it go. Yeah, so that's the long and short history of Metatopia Multiverse. And who knows, I may yet, go back to that if the metaverse picks up.
Yeah.
But see, now here's the big fallacy about the metaverse is that one of the things that they are doing is borrowing the concept of Bitcoin, where scarcity creates value, right? The problem is that a digital world has no scarcity because you can always link in another address,
right,
and expand. And this is where I think it's going to fall flat on its face eventually, because someone like me is going to come along and go, hey, guess what? I'm going to give you a piece of software that lets you run a little local server. You build your own part of the world, and that gets integrated into the world that you go into, right?
Yeah.
And it simply drops you at some outskirt point of the existing world. Now, obviously in Minecraft, they tend to have a limited size planet, right? It's generated from a random number generator. Then once the map is laid out, it's pretty well laid out. They don't necessarily have expansion mechanisms, right? But the point is that as long as you can create a new number on a computer, mm-hmm. you can create new space in the multiverse. So there is no scarcity. And so for it to the concept of it having the same sort of value added capability to that of Bitcoin just seems crazy.
It seems that it would make more sense for them to like partner with an existing platform.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like if they partnered with Bitcoin, it would make more sense.
Oh, right. Yeah. No, see, they wanted to create their own tokens.
Right. Right.
Right. And the best way of making a ton of money is if you can create a coin, put half of it in your pocket, put the rest of it in the public, and everybody else makes you money.
Right. Right.
And there's no regulation, no laws, nothing to prevent you from. I just think the whole thing is funny because I wanted to put that out there for free.
Was that, in a sense, like that, where you could create a world and then the other worlds could join together and you could go from one world to the other, Minecraft?
Yeah, every world provided a portal.
Oh.
Right, and so once you opened up your portal and activated your site, you would publish that portal address, to just like a DNS.
Wow.
Right? And so you could walk into the portal and boom, here's this whole list of different locations, different worlds you could go to.
Ah.
And you teleport. And what that does is that sends your data into their little part of the world, and their system then starts communicating with you and showing you their world and showing the world you. Not complicated. And it's not hard to write code to do.
Remember they wanted to try to do that with VRML initially.
Yes.
I remember Netscape and using the VRML applications that they had back then in the 80s. I think they very much wanted to try to do that, but VRML didn't seem to go very far either, did it?
Well, one of the first proposed standards for VRML was Mark DeGroote's format.
Wow.
So,
what made his format so unique and special at that time? Was he using a particular kind of code or programming language that set it apart from everyone else?
Well, no, I mean it's virtually identical to the first version of VRML, where you're passing object descriptors and primitives. And as such, likewise, you could pass an object, and that object would be fully qualified with its physical description and little bits of code that described its behavior. Right? Every object carried its behavior with it. And so each object could transfer from world to world to world, and it would act and look the same.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't spend a lot of time digging into his contributions to VRML, but he was definitely one of the early ones.
Well, what was the language that he used?
Forth.
And tell us about Forth.
Well, Forth is, I'd almost have to call it an occultist computer language. Because there are very few people that know it, right? It is being employed. It's when the UPS guy comes to your door with that handheld that you sign.
Right.
Everything inside that's running on a Forth engine.
No kidding.
Yeah. Likewise, the guy who invented it, Chuck Moore, big fan, was also kind of Mark's idol. He idolized Chuck, and he would have been so jealous if he'd found out that I actually eventually wound up working for Chuck Moore.
Oh, no kidding.
At one of his companies, IntelliSys, where he was actually burning hardware to run Forth natively. And I got to do a couple projects, and I fell in absolute love with the language, even though I had been introduced to it back in about 1982. You know, I just didn't get a lot of opportunity to work with it. Since I learned Forth, I have loathed having to work in any other language. I'm an expert in many, many different software languages, including the latest C++, right? But there's nothing I would rather work in than Forth. Forth has this unique distinction in that it allows you to write what I would call atomic code, where you have only exactly the number of operations necessary to get a job done. It is hyper efficient. And in some cases, say for instance, in C++, I want to build an object, and then that object talks to another object, right? And so now I've doubled the size of the code. With Forth, you build another one object, and then you take all of the parts that are common to it, and you add that, and the only difference you have in size is the little extra bit that actually makes the difference between the two pieces of code. And so your code doesn't double in size. Effectively, relative to C, it gets smaller.
Wow.
And it's a real mind blower because it allows you to write super, super small, super, super tight code. And in this day and age, when we're really concerned about energy, right? We're concerned about the environment and the pollution. Every year, we're creating bigger and bigger and bigger and more wasteful computers. You can heat a house on what some of these gaming desktops generate in the way of BTUs.
Oh, yeah.
It's insane. And so we've gone from a standard 250 watt to now 750 watt power supply as a standard. Mm-hmm. And this was all planned by guys like Bill Gates and Michael Dell and so forth 20 some odd years ago, when they said, okay, every year we're going to introduce bigger hardware and an operating system that's going to eat every bit of that speed advantage you just got. Wow. And so year over year, your computer will never look like it's speeding up. It'll just be running more and more garbage in the background. I'm not a fan of Microsoft. I am not. In fact, I will state that openly. They just torque my wrench at every freaking turn. So if we were actually to make this
a revolution, not a sponsor.
Yeah, don't ask them to sponsor
Adobe. I love you, Adobe. I love everything you do. Thank you so much for all of your help and support throughout the years. Thank you.
All right, okay, so here we go. Yeah, a little shout out to the people with the money.
Yeah,
understood.
Yeah.
You got to do it.
Well, they did donate software to the Foundation for Sound Living, our nonprofit organization. So they're big supporters of our artists and our artist community. They're a big supporter of the podcast. And so I do mean it sincerely when I'm giving a shout out to Adobe.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, like my shout out's Chuck Moore.
Right on. Excellent.
If we could convince the world of programmers to convert everything to Forth, the computer that you have in front of you could run 100 times more code in real time, in parallel,
than it currently
does.
Maybe we should provide links and more information on the. We could, in fact, why don't we dedicate an episode of Open Talk to Forth, and we can share links and more information about the code and where to learn about it and build your knowledge base on Forth.
Sure, there are plenty of free variants out there. There's also what's called FigForth, which is the Forth interest group.
Oh, well.
And the Forth interest group is largely composed of a bunch of people who are so old that they make the guys on Mount Rushmore look like young pups.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, one of my favorite guys is John Reibel.
Right on.
Yeah, he and I and Jeff Fox were working directly under Chuck Moore during the IntelliSys days. And these guys taught me so much. They changed my perspective on software engineering in ways that, put it this way, we write blocks of code, right, that do different things, and then we chain them together to do a pipeline function, like for instance for rendering, right? Everybody that is in the business knows that you string together filters to make a very precisely rendered object with all of this stuff. What John Reibel and I did with a hearing aid that used a long chain of filters was to stop looking at them as discrete pieces of software. And instead, we wrote them as a single mathematical formula. Right? So filter A plus filter B plus filter C plus so on is equal to a single formula for filtering the audio for a given set of bands. What we did was, since we rendered it as a math function, we're able to do algebraic reduction, taking components from pieces of code that were running in different CPUs and combining them into a single shorter form formula, and then turning that back into code.
All right.
And it reduced the size of the code by an order of magnitude and increased the speed by about 20 times.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It's a concept that is completely ignored.
Mind-blowing.
In modern-day programming, right. Right. Okay. I spend 99% of my time thinking about the projects that I'm working on.
Right on.
And in fact, you've asked me some questions about what my dominant project is right now. Metatopia was a past project.
Yes.
Axis Seating Solutions, or the ergonomic chair, was another project. And of course, the latest one.
Viewable at Terracella.net.
That's, well, it's not available. not since Hurricane Maria, wiped out the vinyl plants that supplied my materials. They've never recovered. Never recovered, right? And my sense of quality and price demand that I had that material at that price. So now, you know, rather than being able to sell a chair for $300-$400, it's $1,000.
Oh no! Oh my!
Yeah. So I put that on the back burner, and now I've taken a new hit on one of my future, well, something I've been working on for 10 years.
Your current project that you want to talk about?
Yeah. Yeah, Metamorphics.
Ah, yes. We are going to dedicate an entire episode, probably many episodes, to what you're going through, what you've been through, and what that's all about, because that's just been keeping, you said, for the last 10, 12 years you've been working on that project?
So. Well, just under 10. Well, just under 10. It's taken that long to file patents.
Wow.
Yeah.
And just briefly, I don't even want to get into Metamorphics in this episode. We don't have enough time. But I would like to maybe pick up on our next episode. I'd like to talk about Metamorphics with you if we could.
Sure.
A great place to pick up. Maybe start at the very beginning. Start, you know, do the whole origin story and go from there. Start back and set the Wayback Machine to 10 years ago and work our way forward.
Well, you're in luck because recently I went about recreating all of my early experiments.
Awesome.
The plan was to start recording last weekend. But my stupid camera, I have a GoPro knockoff, right? But I've had it so long that the battery now only holds charge for about 20 minutes.
Oh, geez.
You know, I have a very demanding day job. It eats up so much of my life. In fact, last night, I was crunching spreadsheets till almost 8 o'clock. And just to be able to take all of the... You know, okay, it took me a week and a half to collect the data, right? Work until almost 7 o'clock every night at the fab, at the factory, surgical robotics, right? And so I'm running these experiments as a three-man team. It's taken all three of us to really dig into this thing, generate the data, and then figure out how to visualize it properly. And I finished that at 8 o'clock last night.
Okay.
It's going to meetings on Monday. So my life is just very demanding for the day job, and I have very little time and energy for all of the other stuff that I wish I could work on. My dream has always been, if there ever came a day when I was independently wealthy, then I could spend all of my time just working on my own projects. And things like Metatopia may come back to life, chair, and all that good stuff.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
I've seen the chair. I want one. We're going to have to find an alternative material source. I know you were talking about hemp-based material at one point, so I would love to see one, you know, like that. That'd be awesome.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize that hemp cloth is so much more durable than cotton.
Yeah.
Oh, it's insane. In fact, that's a market that really just is undervalued. If we could get more... and the stuff grows at an astronomical rate. In Ohio, we called it ditch weed. No, I'm not kidding. Because along every rural route, hundreds of miles of this stuff just sprouting up out of the ditches. Right? That's what all the original sailing rope was made of.
Right.
Right? And that stuff lasted forever. It is tougher than snot. In fact, actually, there was a really cool experiment somebody did when I was working on a synthetic pollinator, a little bee robot. They found that if you took hemp and denatured it down to the cellular structure, it actually creates a conductor much like graphene.
Huh.
Which is, if you've watched over the decades now that it's, since its discovery, has found a bazillion new, just astonishing applications. One of which I really wanted to see go further was the fact that when graphene is properly laid out, it offers zero resistance. It's like a superconductor.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I won't go into too much detail, but a lot of what I'm doing with my Metamorphics requires or leans on small differences in resistance to electrical current and heat and just a whole bunch of stuff. And I always thought, God, it would be great if I could get a superconductor like that, because then it makes a lot easier for me, right? If you know anything about the internals of electronics, for instance, you go to the most fundamental digital component, which is gate, and or not, XOR. So I won't go too much into that. But these fundamental building blocks are built hundreds of transistors. And if you look at how they're operating together, they only operate on small, tiny deltas in power levels to do their switching. Now, in the electronics industry, we look at this as just a given that it's going to work. But in truth, it just barely works.
Wow.
Right?
Far out.
So, yeah, at any rate. So, I don't know what else to say. I've been babbling. You know, I go off on tangents, and I apologize for
that.
Well,
that's why we call the show Open Talk. We can have open conversation about any topic without any restrictions, and try to make things as comfortable as possible for you, the guest, so that we can have that freedom to discuss these conversations. I know the listeners are going to be fascinated by all of these various topics, and it's going to lead them down various rabbit holes. So, you know, sharing a diversity of information, I think, is... bonus. Thank you so much.
You know, I will never dissuade anyone from running down an intellectual rabbit hole, because that's how I learned a lot of what I do.
Right on.
I don't hold any degrees. I'm completely self-taught.
Wow.
Right? I operate as an engineer in electronics, mechanics, software, now material sciences, metallurgy, surface chemistry, microfluidics. Yeah, the first time I exposed some actual seasoned mechanical engineers to this stuff, they just went, wait, what?
Far out. I can't wait. So thank you for joining us, Mr. Gibson Elliott, everyone. If I had an audience, I'd tell them to give you a round of applause. We'll have to dub that in later.
Okay. Yeah, get the laugh tracks too, man.
Oh, for sure. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you soon.
All right, Grant, bye. You have a good one.
You too.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here with us. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this concludes our first test pilot episode of Open Talk with your host, Grant Garrison. And we hope that you will be joining us in the near future for another episode.
Thank you for joining us on Open Talk with Grant Garrison. Please join us again on our next episode, and click like and subscribe.